John S. Doyle has what it says in the papers.
The Irish Times reports that the two-week quarantine period for people arriving into the state from abroad will be lifted for those coming from countries where the coronavirus has been controlled, under plans being considered by the government. The paper says that the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, told a private call with Fine Gael councillors earlier this week that he is examining lifting the current restrictions for countries which have a low number of COVID-19 cases and a low rate of reproduction. Plans of a future government provide the lead story for the Irish Independent. Hugh O'Connell reports that parents will get more money to offset creche fees, and the state will play a greater role in providing childcare under plans being discussed by the three parties in government talks. He writes that a new streamlined regulation system for the sector and pay increases for staff linked to improved qualifications are also being discussed by Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens. There is more looking to the future in the Irish Examiner's lead story. The paper reports that parents were thrown into confusion yesterday after the Minister for Education, Joe McHugh, spoke about students not returning to school in September as usual. Speaking on RTE Radio yesterday, he said it is very hard to see all students back in September, even with a 1 metre rule. He spoke of blended learning, that is, a mix of learning in a classroom and online at home. And he said, we are waiting to see what sort of blended education system we are going to have. The Irish Daily Mail leads with a report that the government is under pressure to scrap plans for teachers to destroy documents used to grade the leaving certificate. The paper says that Fianna Fáil, Sinn Féin and the Social Democrats have criticised the Department of Education's advice under which teachers would destroy securely documents they generate while assessing students for calculated grades. The Irish Daily Star's front page story has a photograph of a man it describes as a notorious gangland killer, Cotton Eye Joe Delaney, who it says has been released after serving 20 years for a brutal murder. Paul Healy reports that Delaney, now 71, became Ireland's first convicted gangland killer after he abducted and tortured Mark Dwyer. He told the paper he had been framed, Healy writes. The Belfast Telegraph reports that a number of relaxations to the coronavirus lockdown in Northern Ireland have been announced, but won't happen until the 8th of June, and only if the infection rate remains under control. Small outdoor weddings would be allowed, some retailers could open, and hotels could take advance bookings, though they still don't know when they can open, the paper says. And that uncertainty in the hotel sector is the focus of the Irish News lead story. The paper says that hospitality chiefs are warning of job losses on a massive scale. Yesterday was one of the hottest days of the year so far, and there's more on the way, according to the Irish Daily Mirror, which looks forward to a sizzling bank holiday weekend. The paper's front page photograph shows two girls dressed for the weather, jumping for joy at Dollymount Strand in Dublin. The Times was also out at the beach and reports that there was little sign of social distancing at Dublin's swimming spots yesterday. Nick Bradshaw's photo of one bathing place, Sea Point, on the south side, seems to bear that out. At the 40-foot, John Hanafy, who swims there most days, told Ronan McGreevy he was delighted to see so many people about, as long as they stay away from me.
The deaths of 9 more people from COVID-19 infection have been reported here, bringing the toll to 1,639 people. Over half of those losses have been from people living in nursing homes, and we'll be talking more about that later. Our correspondent Sinead Crowley was at the latest coronavirus briefing at the Department of Health and is with us now. Good morning, Sinead. 9 more deaths, 46 new cases and a small number of people needing hospital treatment. Part of a pattern described as astonishingly stable.
Yes, and obviously those 9 people remembered last night, and it's difficult to report deaths like that, and that was mentioned last night. However, when you look at the other figures, there was certainly some grounds for optimism at the briefing last night. For example, 46 confirmed cases, that pattern now significantly below 100 for quite some time. That's seen as a good place to be. And also other issues in terms of going into hospitals, ICU admissions, hospital admissions. At the briefing the previous night, Dr. Tony Houlihan had said he had been slightly worried about the fact that there had been 5 ICU admissions and that was something he was keeping an eye on, but it was too early to show a pattern. Well, the good news is that was back down again last night to 1 ICU admission and just 5 hospital admissions overall, seen as a positive trend. The way he put it was that's the type of figure we were hoping to see. We also heard from Professor Philip Nolan last night, and he was talking about the general trend in hospital admissions, in ICU admissions, and they were all very much going in the right direction. He was also talking about the R number, which has been hovering around 0.5 for some time. That's the reproductive rate of the virus, still around 0.5. And actually, the numbers are so small at this stage, he said it's getting difficult for statisticians to come up with that R number, which clearly difficult for them, but very good news for those of us who are following the number. So he used the phrase astonishingly stable when it came to a lot of the indicators they were looking for. And of course, this is significant, not just on a public health point of view, but because these are the people who are looking at the advice that's going to be given to government in terms of easing of restrictions going to the next stage. And certainly the indications were good last night, even though, of course, they wouldn't call it this far out, but certainly the indications seem to be good.
A lot of focus on nursing homes after those reports detailing the homes where people have died and comparing deaths in nursing homes here to other countries. Here's what the Chief Medical Officer Tony Houlihan had to say.
The majority of countries across Europe not reporting anything other than laboratory confirmed cases, but we're reporting laboratory and probable cases, and we're reporting mortality from irrespective of where those mortalities occur. Our colleagues in the UK haven't been reporting that from the beginning, and I'm sure you're well aware of that. And we think we can robustly say, and it's set out in the report, that our mortality experience, while it's not what we'd want to see in general terms, is a mortality experience that has that compares in this way among the lower numbers of countries across Europe. And bearing in mind that Europe has been the epicentre of this infection in the world for the 2 or 3 months that we've had this this infection in this part of the world.
What else was said, Sinead?
Yeah, that survey or that report he referred to is one that was published by the Department of Health last night about mortality rates, and it looks at, it's a technical document, but it does look at issues including population density and the methods of reporting, as he said there, and making the point that different countries have different methods of reporting, and we've spoken about that in this programme before. But when all of those things are taken into account, Ireland's mortality rate is not as it might immediately appear when these figures are looked at, and quite, the department saying it's relatively quite low. But other than that, Kathleen McClellan from the Department of Health also at the briefing last night, and she was questioned about the engagement between Nursing Homes Ireland and also the Department of Health at all stages of this pandemic, and she said that there had been clear engagement between them. She described the engagement as a problem solving way, and she said there are now 23 COVID response teams providing multidisciplinary support for the sector and significant guidance. Now, she did accept, and obviously nursing homes a big story yesterday, and people continually remembering what happened there and thinking of the families. She said it has been a difficult time for nursing home staff, relatives and of course residents, but that progress has now been made. She also made the point that the virus will be with us for some time, she said 6 to 18 months. So, you know, we have to make sure the system is as robust as possible. And a point made by many speakers last night is that this is a new virus, so we are learning all of the time. And I think that applies across the board, whether it be to nursing homes, general public health or even schools. This is something that is being learned from the whole time.
Yes, and we'll be talking more about nursing homes a little later in the programme. You were reporting on schools in the bulletin too, and how children are affected by the virus. What more is known now?
Yeah, that's that point again made last night, that we are learning all of the time. Obviously, very early on in this pandemic, it was thought that children actually spread it quite widely now, that doesn't seem to be the case. Now, Dr. Houlihan asked last night about the advice that he will be given to government on schools and on various areas, and he did make the point that they don't just, obviously they look at the best available research, but they also look at the situation in other countries, because Ireland is, I suppose, lucky is one way of putting it, in that this pandemic hit here later than some other countries, so we are able to look at them and see how things are going on there. So some reassurance, I suppose, can be found in the fact that even as measures eased in other other countries, there doesn't seem to have been significant increase in infection in them, in terms of schools or even retail or, you know, these areas where people are moving around together. So these are the type of things that they are looking at when they take into account the advice they will give to government. We're still a week out from any decision on easing of restrictions, and we know that NPHET will meet again next week to consider its final advice to the government. They're not going to say what it is at this stage, but certainly those are the type of things they're looking at as hopefully they give advice and, you know, towards the possible next easing of restrictions.
And another sign, Sinead, of the virus that should prompt people to look for a test.
That's right, yeah, and again, this comes back to the fact that it's changing all the time. You know, we had been hearing so much about the dry cough and the temperature and so on, but there had also been reports of this idea of loss of smell and loss of taste. So this now looks likely will be included in the case definition of the virus. NPHET agreed in principle to include it yesterday. They're waiting for guidance from the ECDC, which is expected to be published today. And in that case, the sudden loss of smell or the loss of taste should be something that should alert you. If you're experiencing that, even if you don't have other symptoms, then contact your GP and look for a test, because again, testing is now available, and really the health services here, they want to get a handle on the virus and find out who has it. And interestingly, it came up at the HSE briefing yesterday as well, that people can be asymptomatic with the virus. For example, when contact tracing is done, when close contacts are done, I think around 12% of people contacted so far had the virus, but 73% of them were asymptomatic. So even if you feel like you've contacted for a test and you're asymptomatic, go and get the test anyway. If the health services feel you need a test, then you should go and get a test. But also now from today, if you have something that you might consider minor, maybe loss of taste or loss of smell, then you are being encouraged to get the test so they can get a handle on where the virus is in the community.
Sinead, thank you. That's our correspondent, Sinead Crowley. And Sinead mentioned Philip Nolan, the chair of the NPHET's Irish Epidemiological Modelling Advisory Group. We'll be speaking to him after 8 o'clock.
It's almost 4 months since the general election, and for once it's not hyperbole to say that in that time the world has changed. Government formation talks between negotiators from Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party are due to resume later today. Joining us is the Irish Times Deputy Political Editor, Fiac Kelly. Fiac, talks were scheduled for last night, but it seems they didn't happen.
Yes, Rachel, there's due to be a session on housing late last evening and it was postponed. We understand housing is one of the issues in which there are some problems between three sides. In particular, the Green Party seems to have an issue with the structure of the Land Development Agency. This is the agency established by the last government, although it has to be given full legislative footing yet, to basically encourage development of housing on state land. There are some people in the Green Party who feel that, in effect, what it's doing is handing over public land to private developers. That is not what people in Fine Gael say, and people in Fianna Fáil say they want the supply of housing speeded up no matter what the mechanism. So a bit of difficulty there. So I think what we've seen this week is that last week a lot of the easier issues were dealt with. This week in the talks, they're getting into more difficult terrain about housing, about the deficit, about the public finances, and that's why we've seen a bit of a slowdown this week. The mood music isn't as good as it was last week. Everybody still thinks that a programme for government will be agreed, but maybe it's not. The talks maybe are not as in a more optimistic space or as an optimistic space as they were this time last week.
Because whatever way you look at it, the challenges are enormous.
Absolutely, and as you said, the world has changed, and one of the sticking points this week was the level of state spending that has gone on in the last 3 months. How do you tackle the deficit that is going to arise? So we know that what's expected this week or this year will be a deficit of around 30 billion euro, if not more. The Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil negotiators, Michael McGrath and Pascal Donoghue, were said to be at one, that the next government must give a signal to the market that the deficit must come down. Some in the Green Party, such as Nasa Hurricane, the finance spokeswoman, expressed a view that this could mean austerity or spending cuts. Now, if you look at the exchange between the Taoiseach and Eamon Ryan in the House earlier this week, it seemed to provide a path by which that particular conundrum can be settled, whereby the government for the first 2 to 3 years of its lifetime would focus on economic growth through borrowing and then tackle the deficit. But these are the problems that are now facing the negotiators because of what's changed in the last few months. A lot of the projects that would have been looked for example, the money, it may not be there for them, but all the parties are now expressing their interests and their own self-interest. So what we saw this week as well is Fine Gael putting out a signal that the roads projects in Project Ireland 2040, the last government's capital development plan, are said to be a red line for them. The Taoiseach told a private call with Fine Gael councillors that he wants those projects protected. This comes against the backdrop of some in the Green Party in recent years saying they would like to see some of that money diverted to cycling and walking infrastructure. Now, there will still be money for cycling and walking infrastructure, but Fine Gael is clearly laying down a marker there as well.
Are independent deputies being consulted?
They are, and interestingly, earlier this week and late last week, the two people who were keeping them on side were largely Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin and Taoiseach to Simon Coveney. So they were in touch with those group of independents. The regional group in particular are seen as key. That's Dennis Nocton, Michael Lowry, Verona Murphy. Those set of deputies are seen as the more reliable, if you like, non-party TDs that Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and the Greens can reach for. There is a view among some in Fine Gael, amongst the parliamentary party, Dublin South West, Colin Brophy being one of them, that the two parties would be better off going to the regional independents and the Green Party. They think they would be more stable partners for a five-year term of office. But there is a feeling among some in the independent group that perhaps they're being taken for granted, that the parties are just keeping them there on standby if the Greens do not eventually go into government. And some person said to me that the independents are waiting for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael to come to them if the Greens do not enter government, but they'll make Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael pay a price for that delay in seeking their support.
This can't go on forever. When might we see progress in your assessment?
It was initially hoped that we'd see progress at the end of this week. Now people are saying middle of next week. That's probably a bit too optimistic given the mood music we're hearing around the challenges that still have to be faced. Next week is seen as particularly crucial. One senior person in one of the parties said to me last night that next week is the week when decisions on these thorny issues will have to be taken. I still think you're looking at a Dáil electing a Taoiseach at the back end of June now, because bear in mind the parties have to have votes. Fianna Fáil is going to have an Ord Cóirle meeting next week where it's going to set out the mechanism by which you will have a postal vote. The Taoiseach has told his party he wants all three parties to synchronise their ballot the results, so there's no surprises, if you like, when the results are announced. One party won't colour the considerations of the other. That'll be probably a two-week process after a programme for government is agreed, so you're probably looking at a programme for government within the next week to 2 weeks, and all going well, a ballot that will last 2 weeks with a result announced towards the back end of June, and a Taoiseach probably elected by the start of July or the late end of June.
Fia Kelly of the Irish Times, thank you for joining us.
The country's largest cemetery has witnessed a huge surge in demand for its services since the outbreak of the coronavirus. The Glasnevin Trust has said during late March and early April, burials and cremations were up as high as 80% when compared to the same period last year. Conor Hunt spent the afternoon at the cemetery to see what effects the pandemic is having there.
Here, since the 1830s, through famine, war and disease, Glasnevin Cemetery is now grappling with the coronavirus.
I've never actually seen anything like this before, obviously. Like I said, we did have times where we would have been very busy. But this is consistent. This is going on for the last couple of months, just non-stop. It is hard now, I would say. Like, you can't let that be seen, obviously. The way, you know, when the family arrive here, you have to be professional.
John Campbell is a crematorium technician. He's worked here for over 40 years. One day last month, he oversaw 12 cremations, all the while adhering to strict social distancing guidelines. Seeing families of COVID victims is particularly tough, he says.
Very sad on them. They wouldn't be like other families would have had the chance to say goodbye to their loved one before they passed. Whereas the COVID families, victims, their families wouldn't have been able to hold a hand or hug them or kiss them or their final goodbye. It's very, very hard on them. And obviously when the family arrive here, there's only 10 family members allowed in for the service, which is very difficult to be saying to family, sorry, we can only allow 10 in, like due to the government guidelines. Majority of the families are okay. You may get the odd family that are probably not happy about it, but when you explain to them that it's for their benefit, their health, our health, and everybody else's health, you know, you start to realise that, yeah, fair enough, it's those you're right, and they go along with it.
Glasnevin has remained open throughout this pandemic, and because of its size and location, it's been very busy. The number of cremations and burials here over the last few weeks is up as high as 80% on the same period last year. Aoife Waters is the CEO.
Really, for us, we saw ourselves as needing to step up to the plate to respond to a national emergency. We've been really tragically very busy. It's been really challenging because I suppose there's a delicate balance on the one hand between public health and protecting the health of the nation, and on the other hand, seeing really the shutdown, if you like, of funeral practices. It's been unimaginable, you know, a few short weeks ago that we could be in a situation where ultimately funeral practices and funerals are restricted.
But there's also life in this cemetery. Members of the public can still visit. And the coronavirus has bought some people, like Derek Houghton, some extra free time. For the last 2 weeks, he's been using it to visit his parents' grave and clean the headstone. When we find him, he has a scraper and paintbrush in hand.
Yeah, it's sentimental. It is sentimental. It's a good opportunity to come down, because like that again, we can forget about the graveyard and the graves, and you know, you'd normally just come up maybe on their anniversaries or Christmas and that, but as I said, I've spent kind of 2.5 weeks coming and going, and so I've enjoyed it and I'm enjoying it, yeah.
The COVID restrictions have also had an unusual effect. Fewer tourists mean fewer flowers on the grave of Michael Collins, Deb's grave too. This, though, is a working cemetery with not much downtime. And as we leave, preparations are already underway for the next service. 3 in just 2 hours.
Conor Hunt reporting from Glasnevin Cemetery.
Volkswagen is to pump €2 billion into two separate Chinese electric vehicle players. The joint venture will launch 5 more electric models over the next 5 years. The German carmaker aims to sell 1.5 million new energy vehicles in China by 2025. French carmaker Renault is set to announce 15,000 job cuts worldwide as it unveils a plan to cope with falling sales. Some 4,500 jobs are expected to go in France. The group, which is 15% owned by the government, had earlier this year flagged financial problems before the COVID-19 outbreak. FDI to Ireland is expected to drop by 20% this year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. That's according to a new report from EY Ireland. It says that Ireland ranks number 8 in Europe in terms of attractiveness, and it expects it will fare better than many other countries post-COVID-19. I'll have more on that at 10 to 8. And finally for now, a look at the currencies. €1 buys 90 pence sterling and $1 11 cents.
Over half of the people lost to coronavirus here were older people living in nursing homes. Details were published yesterday of the 166 homes where most of those 900 people lived. Merrymount Care Centre in Lucan, County Dublin, was identified in the Irish Times yesterday as having lost 28 of its residents to COVID-19. Fergus McNulty is one of the owners of the care centre. He told Mary Wilson on Drive Time last night that they felt at the outset they were well equipped to cope. Instead, they experienced devastation.
Our plans, I suppose, went into implementation mode early to mid-March, increasingly, and then, you know, obviously they progressed from there. You know, I would have to say, and this is why I think it's really, really important that as we all collectively reflect on this, and we've obviously had a devastating impact, we did everything that was asked of us and everything in line with guidelines as it relates to you know, infection control and so on. And, you know, the team, you know, did an unbelievable job through that process. But clearly, you know, that was not sufficient, and it you know, it has had the impact that it's had. So certainly from our perspective, I think, you know, finding ways of understanding what's happened, you know, we have the benefit of a very, you know, modern facility. We have 16 acres here. Our rooms are very spacious. We're predominantly single-roomed. You know, we have staff quarters in different parts of the building. So all, on paper, everything that you would say you would want, you know, in terms of having the infrastructure in place, we have. But clearly all of those things were not sufficient.
Fergus McNulty also spoke about the testing of people who lived and worked at the home.
This is definitely not to apportion blame. I think we've, you know, if I were to look at one of the challenges or failures, Systemically, I think the testing process, particularly in the early stages of the COVID crisis, completely failed. And I use those words. So we had residents and staff members who were waiting, you know, perhaps a week for tests, and then you know a week to 2 weeks for actual test results. So any staff member who was symptomatic was not at work. Any resident who is displaying signs of symptoms were put into isolation. We were crying out for blanket testing in early April to give us a better picture in terms of how to manage and how to control. Unfortunately, that didn't happen until the 20th of April. When we got those results back, you know, a significant number of staff and residents came back positive, but to a person, they were all asymptomatic.
Fergus McNulty, one of the owners of Marymount Care Centre in Lucan. Let's speak now to Professor Carina Nocton of UCC. She's a professor of clinical nursing and older persons healthcare, and also to Sean Kennelly, consultant physician in geriatric medicine at Tallaght University Hospital. Thank you both very much for joining us on the programme this morning. Sean Kennelly, I'll come to you first of all. In individual nursing homes like Fergus's, it's hard to overestimate the effect of losing several residents in homes. In some homes, almost half of the people living there died. The HSE-run Rock Nursing Home in Ballyshannon in County Donegal experienced 10 deaths at a facility that had a maximum occupancy of 22. Padre Pio Nursing Home in Clondalkin had 13 deaths in an occupancy of 31. Is it understood now why that happened?
Good morning, Evan. And there's no way to overstate the very tragic consequences of COVID-19 that's occurred in nursing homes, and how families and indeed the staff in nursing homes are still very much grieving the loss of loved ones. And in a conversation with the director of nursing from one of those nursing homes recently, where they were talking about the silence that's in the nursing home and the number of vacant beds and how they find the atmosphere even quite suffocating still. But to come to your question as to why we do we know why some nursing homes were disproportionately affected compared to others, I think it's still very unclear, and I suppose this is one of the key issues for that expert review panel that's been established by the minister for them to address. Because I suppose in the common conversation, and even it was interesting to see where HICWA had mentioned that they would have had pre-existing concerns about some nursing homes and the resilience and ability to cope. Certainly, in the experience that I've had with working with nursing homes, that it hasn't always been the nursing homes that you would have expected to run into difficulties, and indeed some of the nursing homes that I would know to be very, very high performing, that would be very, very good and conscientious about the manner of care that they're able to deliver to the residents. They have some of those nursing homes were nursing homes most affected. And I think we also have to come back to the context of the pandemic, how it spread. The fact that, when it was coming out of China, we thought there was 1% to 2% asymptomatic spread. It turned out to be that there is 20% asymptomatic spread, so people without symptoms. The atypical nature of symptoms quickly evolved, and we were one of the first countries to identify that only a third of older people were developing fever, whereas that was part of the key criteria for testing. So we weren't testing people who didn't have fever and who didn't have cough at those stages. And then the virulence, we thought, if you got it, you might spread it to one or two people, but it actually turned out if you had it, there was the potential for you to be spreading it to four to five people. And then when you put that together with the nature of care in nursing homes, which is so close contact,
yes,
you're helping them to walk, you're helping them to feed, it just meant that once it became established in a nursing home, it was often very difficult to get it back under control.
Professor Carina Nocton, HICWA have yet to go into the nursing homes that have experienced high outbreaks of coronavirus to understand exactly what happened there. But in advance of perhaps a return of the virus, one which hasn't gone away yet, and trying to protect remaining residents and those who continue to be transferred from nursing homes from being infected, getting sick, or dying in the coming months, what can be done?
Good morning, Gavin. And first, let me start by expressing my condolences to the families and friends of all those people who have lost their lives during this epidemic. So you hit on exactly what it is that we need to focus on now. We need to shift our energies and our resources to identifying the models of best practice from the high-performing nursing homes and as Sean said, these are often not the homes that we would have traditionally described as high performing. But why was it that some nursing homes had no outbreaks or managed outbreaks very, very successfully? What was it that those nursing homes were doing? Why did it work? In what context did it work? We have to understand not just what went wrong in the homes that where they did have much higher outbreaks, but what was happening in the homes where this didn't happen. They're the models of best practice that we need to learn from, and we need to be able to replicate at scale. One of the things that I want to focus on is staffing levels and competency. It is a core pillar in all care, and in particular gerontological nursing, and the expertise of nurses in terms of the unique knowledge base that is older adult nursing. So that's something that I would very much like to see as part of that review. What were the numbers like of nurses in those care homes? What was their skills level? What was their competencies? Did they have that higher level knowledge and skills that you get with higher level postgraduate education and your continuous professional development? That is part of what this inquiry also needs to look at.
Sean Kennelly, you work with a number of nursing homes in the southwest part of Dublin, a part of the country which has been particularly affected by the virus. In many of these homes' case, is it simply impossible to successfully isolate patients, for example, because of the environment that they live in?
So I think there's a lot of factors, and I would agree with much of what Karina has said. I think there has been some factors that, you know, are probably clear. Nursing homes who developed patients with symptoms or who had COVID early on in the pandemic, I think they had far greater challenges in managing it. I think we learned a lot as the pandemic unfolded, and actually more recent outbreaks have been far easier or far, you know, less challenging to manage and get under control. I think the other key factor with regards why some nursing homes were more affected than others was the level of community spread. So if you were a nursing home based in a community where there was high levels of COVID-19, it became very difficult for you to stop staff members acquiring that in the community and coming in and spreading it further. The nature of some of the buildings, I mean, some of the nursing homes at the upper end of those of that list that was published yesterday would be some of the nursing homes that would have all of those factors that Karina have mentioned with regards to gerontological nursing skill set and a clinical skill set around them, and would be mostly single room nursing homes. And in fact, since 2015, HICWA have been very much reviewing nursing homes on the basis of single room occupancy. So I don't think it's just on that factor, but there are certainly other environmental factors that need to be considered.
Lots more to consider. Sean Kennelly and Professor Karina Nocklin, thank you both very much for speaking to us this morning.
The COVID-19 crisis has led to hundreds of thousands of people working remotely, many for the first time. While it brings about a chance for greater work-life balance for some, it also presents challenges. For some workers, poor connectivity is making working from home difficult. For business owners, it's adding to the pressure of staying afloat. Our Northeast correspondent Sinead Hussey met some people in County Meath who are finding working remotely a challenge.
Hi Dave.
Hi, can you hear me?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Hello. I'm good.
David Downs is trying to keep his business going.
Can you hear me?
But simple tasks like keeping in contact with employees who are working remotely is a challenge.
Hi, I can barely hear you.
Yeah.
UMAX Systems is based in Kells, County Meath, and good broadband is essential for the smooth running of the business.
Well, we rely on good, strong broadband connectivity to allow us to conduct our business. We provide software services to the water and wastewater sector and the refrigeration industry. Without strong broadband, it's virtually impossible for us to conduct our business. It increases the time it takes to conduct business. We see an impact in productivity and efficiency. So it is difficult for us to conduct our business effectively unless we are in a location where there is strong broadband.
25 minutes away in Dunshaughlin, Sinead O'Kane is also struggling. She works in financial services in Dublin, and since March has been based at her kitchen table.
You take a lot of stuff for granted, I suppose, when you are actually in work. So basically, I'd have a lot of systems I would have to log into every morning. And now at the moment, if you try to log into several systems at one time, it would crash you. So you have to kind of log it. So there's not a monotony of logging in and out of different systems at different times. If you're doing kind of large, I suppose, work cases and you input too much into the system, it might crash. So there's a lot of kind of manual workarounds where you have to go start typing it into Word to move it to the system. I suppose there's also a lot of internal communication systems. So there is the isolation there whenever your internet cuts out that you can't hear the call. So it's hard to, you know, link in with your team workers and colleagues to even tell them that, you know, I'm out of the system right now. And then obviously there is system outages. If you're lucky, it could be 5 minutes, but it could be anywhere to 15 to 20 minutes.
These sort of challenges are adding to the pressure of working from home.
In the mornings when I would have been going into work sitting on the bus, I was never envisioning, I wonder, is the internet going to work? Never would have walked in straight to my colleagues and saying, hey team, you know, is the internet working? It was just something you took completely for granted. So I suppose there is that anxiety every morning. Am I going to be able to log into this system? How long is it going to work for? You know, and there's, you know, if this was long term, you have to accept that you're a mediocre worker now because you just don't have the facility to kind of work properly all the time. So there is just a lot of added pressure. It'd be different if I was 2 hours away from good internet, but when you know you're 5-10 minutes away from good internet, it's very, very frustrating, I suppose. If I was to go long term, I just have to accept that I wouldn't be as efficient as I would be when I'm, you know, able to work in work. So it's kind of just a case that, yeah, unless the internet did pick up, it wouldn't be something I would choose to do, because like that, you know, I want to advance in my career, and if I'm constantly not being as efficient as I can be, then it wouldn't be something I would consider long term, no.
So what are the options open to workers living outside the main cities? The National Association of Community Enterprise Centres says this is a huge opportunity for regional hubs. Gary O'Mara is chairman and also chief executive of Meath Enterprise.
One thing this lockdown has taught us all, even though we've all been talking about remote working for some time now, is that remote working permanently is maybe not the best option long term. But a blended approach or a hybrid approach of some sort to remote work, and where people could work 2 or 3 days from home and 2 or 3 days from a hub, or a few hours from a hub while they're based at home. And the reason they potentially need to be in a local hub is not just the social interaction and the various things that we miss when we're at home on our own, but the access to quality broadband, the opportunity to network, the opportunity to engage face-to-face with people, because creativity and innovation and various other things happen much more naturally when there's face-to-face interaction. You know, we don't want people isolated at home on their own, you know, struggling with Wi-Fi, struggling with poor phone signals, if they're in more kind of remote parts of rural Ireland or whatever the case may be. So, yeah, we want people to interact with the community, come out into these hubs, engage with other companies, other people, startups engaging with multinationals engaging with social enterprises and being more involved in the local community, people spending money, people going to local coffee shops. This is all about rural Ireland, developing rural Ireland, regional development, and there's a real opportunity, I think, as a result of this pandemic, for us to pay real attention to that and do something really powerful here.
Gary O'Mara ending that report from our Northeast correspondent Sinead Hussey.
Foreign direct investment to Ireland could drop by 20% this year due to COVID-19. That's according to the EY European Attractiveness Report published today. It reveals that Ireland is the eighth most attractive European country for foreign investors. That shows that Ireland is moving up in the leaderboard. In 2018, we were in 10th place. We can speak now to Fergal Dufresne, partner and head of FDI with EY Ireland. Fergal, despite moving up in the rankings, there was a 7% drop in the number of FDI projects in 2019 compared to the previous year. Is that worrying?
Good morning, Jill. Thank you. Actually, it isn't, because I think when we consider the performance in 2018, which was a stellar and very strong year for foreign investment into Ireland, we did see a very strong influence of Brexit that year. And in fact, in 2018, the level of investment increased by over 40%. So I think when I look at the performance in 2019, I take great encouragement from the fact that we've essentially sustained that big step increase that we saw after the Brexit impact. I think moving up in the league table to eighth place is a very strong performance as well. Remember, this survey is across 47 countries, not just the EU. And of course, Ireland is small, so when we look at the number of investments per head of population, we're comfortably at the top of the league table.
Like almost every aspect of life, COVID-19 has disrupted FDI. The report says the pandemic is expected to interrupt around 20% of projects. What's the outlook like for new foreign investment going forward?
Yeah, so we obviously had to go and talk to our investors within the last kind of couple of months to get an updated view of their sentiment towards investment. I think a couple of interesting things come out of their views. One is that nobody is really saying that they're going to cut back completely. Investment is going to continue. I think rather what we'll see during the course of 2020 is either a delay of investment that might spill over into next year, or that investment will continue, but that it will be slightly curtailed. So in fact, the picture isn't entirely gloomy. And remember as well that this survey is performed across Europe and does take into account investor sentiment in some of our major markets like the US, which continues to be very important for Ireland.
The findings indicate that a number of different factors will drive investment decisions in a post-COVID world. Is that right?
It is, yeah. I mean, investors in the immediate term are looking at things like the government policy response to COVID, what types of assistance might be available. But investors are also looking into the kind of 3 to 5 year time horizon. And encouragingly, I think for Ireland, some of the key areas that investors will be focused on will be firstly, the space of digital and technology. Ireland is already very strong in what we call high value added services, certainly compared to the rest of Europe. So I think what we're seeing in terms of people being able to work from home, being able to leverage technology in their daily lives, that investment will continue. And I think the talent pool and track record of Ireland in this space is going to be important. I think another area is around supply chain resilience. We hear a lot of that word in the current days. Companies are recognizing that cost minimization is not the only game in town, and that they need to make sure that they can get their products and services safely to their customers. And again, I think Ireland's position in Europe is actually to its advantage, and that there is potential here for us in the future.
We'll have to leave it there. Fergal Dufresne, partner and head of FDI with EY Ireland. Thanks for joining us.
Well, we had a warm day yesterday with temperatures getting up to 26 degrees in places. And it looks set to continue generally dry and settled, with highest temperatures in the low to mid 20s over the bank holiday weekend. And current indications are that it will keep going to the middle of next week, but potentially cooler later on in the week. So for today, it'll be dry and sunny, though we could see some more hazy sunshine at times during the day. Highest afternoon temperatures will range between 21 and 25 degrees in most places, but it'll be slightly cooler in southern and eastern coastal areas due to a moderate south to southeast breeze, and it will be fresher along the southwest coast. Towards evening, it'll become cloudier in the west, and during the night, thicker cloud and showers in the Atlantic may push into some western coastal fringes. But overall, it will be a dry night with long clear spells. Some isolated mist and fog patches may form later in the night. Minimum temperatures of 9 to 12 degrees in light to moderate southeast breezes. Tomorrow will be dry with good sunshine in most places, but cloudier in the west for a time during the morning. The sunshine will become hazier at times during the day in light to moderate southeasterly breezes. But continuing warm, with highest afternoon temperatures of 20 to 25 degrees. Again, cooler along southern and eastern coasts due to the onshore breeze. Tomorrow night will again be dry and mostly clear with patchy mist and fog. Minimum temperatures of 10 to 12 degrees in mostly light easterly breezes. Sunday will be dry and sunny in most areas with highs of 20 to 24 degrees, staying cooler on eastern and southern coasts. Dry and sunny generally on Monday, but there is a chance of the odd light shower during the afternoon, with highs of 22 to 25 degrees. So to recap for today, dry and sunny, but hazy at times. Highs of 21 to 25 degrees, cooler in eastern and southern coasts due to the onshore breeze. That's the forecast. Thank you and have a great morning.
Good morning. This is Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings and Rachel English. The news is read now by Carla O'Brien.
The Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, has said that the National Public Health Emergency Team is looking at the experience in other European countries when it comes to easing measures around schools and childcare. He said that for the most part, other countries have not seen a significant change in infection, which gives a degree of assurance. Sinead Crowley reports.
Speaking at last night's Department of Health briefing, Dr. Houlihan said that when evaluating the impact of COVID-19, the National Public Health Emergency Team considers both existing research and the effect the pandemic has had on other European countries, many of which experienced the virus a few weeks ahead of Ireland. He said some of these countries have been in a position to ease certain measures around school and childcare, and that for the most part they haven't seen significant change in infection, which is giving a degree of assurance in terms of the likely impact of measures of that kind. The Department of Health has also published statistics relating to the mortality rate from COVID-19 in this country compared with others. It shows that when issues including population density and the ways in which deaths are reported are taken into account, Ireland's experience is on the lower end of the European scale, particularly given that Ireland reports all deaths, including probable cases of COVID-19, and deaths in all settings.
Last night, the Minister for Education, Joe McHugh, said he won't accept a half return to school, which would be required if the current 2 metre social distancing guidelines remain in place in September. Mr McHugh told Primetime that children's education could not be held back and he hasn't given up on children fully returning. Samantha Larrary reports.
Yesterday, the Education Minister said on an interview on RTE Radio that it was difficult to see how schools could fully return in September under either a 2 or 1 metre social distancing rule. On last night's Prime Time, Joe McHugh said he wouldn't accept a half return to school in September, that he hasn't given up on children fully returning, and that while he can't act unilaterally to overrule public health advice, that advice is changing and government would be advised by international experiences. He also said he did not want to see children having to wear face masks in school, that children's education could not be held back, that there was evidence of regression in some children, and that he would move mountains to ensure that no child is left behind. He's due to bring a memo to Cabinet on the issue today. He's also announced that the deadline for the registration for calculated grades is extended until midday today. The department says more than 1,000 students haven't yet signed up, and some outstanding queries on the system's help desk are still being worked through.
The Taoiseach Simon Coveney will bring a memo to Cabinet today on Brexit, which maps out how the government should deal with the continuing uncertainty surrounding the UK's future trading relationship with the European Union. It's understood the memo states the Irish government does not believe that Prime Minister Boris Johnson will seek to extend the Brexit transition period, and therefore Ireland should prepare for either a limited trade deal or a no-deal scenario by the end of the year. Our political correspondent Paul Cunningham.
At Cabinet today, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar will provide an update on the fight against coronavirus. Health Minister Simon Harris will bring proposals on the use of private hospitals. However, Brexit will be centre stage. Taoiseach Simon Coveney will seek approval to draft a new omnibus bill, which will cover the needs of 8 government departments as the clock counts down to December 31st. That's when the UK exits the so-called transition period, in which it's remained a part of the EU's customs union and single market, even though it's left the union itself. The EU's lead negotiator, Michel Barnier, has held 3 rounds of talks with the UK on a trade deal. A 4th round is due next week. However, Mr. Coveney believes Prime Minister Johnson wants to exit the transition period at the end of this year, and so the EU will only secure a limited trade deal with the UK, or the talks will collapse and trade will be conducted on World Trade Organization rules. While that would be a bad outcome for Ireland, the UK has already given firm commitments that there can be no return to a hard border, irrespective of what happens in the trade talks.
Government formation talks will resume today, with negotiators from Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party focusing on education. The talks are expected to get underway this afternoon once the Cabinet meeting has been concluded. The US National Guard has been deployed in Minneapolis as violent protests continued for a third night over the death of an unarmed black man in police custody. A Minneapolis Police Department Central Precinct building was set on fire during the latest disturbances. George Floyd died on Monday after an officer knelt on his neck in the street. The policeman involved and three others have all been sacked, but Mr. Floyd's family want them to face murder charges. The senior federal prosecutor for the state of Minnesota, Erica McDonald, said her team had made the investigation into his death its top priority.
We share an unwavering commitment to see that this investigation is done right, that it's done forthwith, that we act with dispatch, and that we live up to the standards the community demands. Our highest priority is that justice will be served.
And now the time is 6 minutes past eight.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Centra. Make the most of summer. We've everything you need at Centra.
Dry and sunny today, although the sunshine may turn a little hazy at times and become cloudier in the west towards the evening. Highest temperatures will range between 21 and 25 degrees in most places, but slightly cooler in southern and eastern coastal areas.
John S. Doyle is here again with It Says in the Papers.
The Irish Times reports that the two-week quarantine period for people arriving into the state from abroad will be lifted for those coming from certain countries, under plans being considered by the government. The paper says that the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, told a private call with Fine Gael councillors earlier this week that he is examining lifting the current restrictions for countries which have a low number of COVID-19 cases and a low rate of reproduction. Plans of a future government provide the lead story for the Irish Independent. Hugh O'Connell reports that parents will get more money to offset creche fees, and the state will play a greater role in providing childcare under plans being discussed by the three parties in government talks. He writes that a new streamlined regulation system for the sector and pay increases for staff linked to improved qualifications are also being discussed by Fine Gael, Fine Gael and the Greens. There is more looking to the future in the Irish Examiner's lead story. The paper reports that parents were thrown into confusion yesterday after the Minister for Education, Joe McHugh, spoke about students not returning to school in September as usual. Speaking on RTE Radio yesterday, he said it is very hard to see all students back in September, even with a 1 metre rule. He spoke of blended learning, that is, a mix of learning in a classroom and online at home. And he said, we are waiting to see what sort of blended education system we are going to have. The Irish Daily Mail leads with the report that the government is under pressure to scrap plans for teachers to destroy documents used to grade the leaving certificate. The paper says that Fianna Fáil, Sinn Féin and the Social Democrats have criticised the Department of Education's advice under which teachers would destroy securely documents they generate while assessing students for calculated grades. The Irish Daily Star leads with a report about a man it describes as a notorious gangland killer, Cotton Eye Joe Delaney, who it says has been released after serving 20 years for murder. Paul Healy reports that Delaney, now 71, became Ireland's first convicted gangland killer after he abducted and tortured Mark Dwyer. He told the paper he had been framed, Healy writes. The Belfast Telegraph reports that a number of relaxations to the coronavirus lockdown in Northern Ireland have been announced, but won't happen until the 8th of June, and only if the infection rate remains under control. Uncertainty in the hotel sector is the focus of the Irish News lead story. The paper says that hospitality chiefs are warning of job losses on a massive scale. And speaking of hotels, The Independent reports that the former Fine Gael TD, Maria Bailey, has initiated defamation proceedings against the publishers of the Irish Daily Mirror over its coverage of so-called swing gate following her claim against the Dean Hotel in Dublin. Yesterday was one of the hottest days of the year so far, and there's more on the way, according to the Mirror, which looks forward to a sizzling bank holiday weekend. The Times reports that there was little sign of social distancing at Dublin's swimming spots yesterday. Nick Bradshaw's photo of one bathing place, Sea Point on the south side, seems to bear that out. The United States is on the minds of three editorial writers. A shameful fault line is how the Times describes the racial divides in that country. The Examiner considers President Trump's executive order about social media and his threat to strongly regulate or close down social media. His threat, the paper says, would be recognized by Hannah Arendt, the German philosopher who has written about how totalitarianism advances. The Independent also comments on President Trump's executive order about social media. There is something preposterous in the truth trampler-in-chief reinventing himself as a champion of free speech, says the writer. Not since the McCarthy era have facts been refashioned so ruthlessly to the detriment of the public.
As we heard on the news, the US National Guard has been deployed to Minneapolis as protests continued for a third night over the death of an unarmed black man. George Floyd died on Monday after a police officer knelt on his neck in the street. A Minneapolis Police Department Central Precinct building was set on fire during the disturbances. The officer involved in Monday's incident and three others have all been sacked, but Mr. Floyd's family want them to face murder charges. Early this morning, the US President Donald Trump tweeted, "Any difficulty and we will assume control, but when the looting starts, the shooting starts." This report from Tommy Meskell.
We got gunshots, guys.
People run from what sounds like gunshots at the burning police station in Minneapolis. The inferno has become a focal point of violent protests, which have now run into a third night. As the building was set alight, fire officers looked on, trying to figure out the best way to respond.
We have to really consider the safety of our firefighters in those areas, so we're being very, very cautious. I know I'm going to make an assessment of that situation around the 3rd Precinct building. And if we can go in and attempt to make a fire attack in that structure, we will.
46-year-old George Floyd died on Monday. The unarmed black man lay on the ground as an officer knelt on his neck. His final words, "I can't breathe." They were the same words chanted by protesters. The demonstration has seen looting, cars set alight, and at least one instance of a car driven into a crowd. Watch out! That's despite an early plea from the vice president of the city council, Andrea Jenkins, for calm.
I want to remind all of the people that are in the streets protesting, you have every absolute right to be angry, to be upset, to be mad, to express your anger. However, you have no right to perpetrate violence and harm on the very communities that you say that you are standing up for.
But divisions run deep. At a rally yesterday, Al Sharpton, a civil rights activist, addressed the crowd.
There are probable cause right now. You have a deceased person. You have a tape showing how he was deceased. You have a tape showing the other three police did nothing to prevent it. Then they should tell these four police what they tell all of us in the hood. Mm-hmm. Tell it to the judge.
Yeah. Gwen Carr, whose son Eric Garner died in 2014 after being placed in a banned police chokehold, said this case is akin to salt in an old wound.
As you know, this happened to me almost 6 years ago. And this is just opening up an old wound, pouring salt into it. They keep coming into, the police officers come into our neighborhoods. They brutalize, they terrorize, they murder our children, and we have done nothing.
I can't breathe!
The U.S. National Guard has been deployed to Minneapolis. Yesterday, the senior federal prosecutor in the state of Minnesota, Erica McDonald, said her team had made the investigation its top priority. But the violence continues, the fires burn, and the anger shows no sign of abating.
Tommy Meskell reporting there.
Astonishingly stable. That's how the man charged with modelling and predicting the course of coronavirus here has described the pattern of people contracting the virus, needing hospital treatment, intensive care, or dying from COVID-19 infection. The deaths of 9 more people have been reported in the last 24 hours here, bringing the toll to 1,639 people. Over half of those losses have been from people living in nursing homes. The government will decide late next week if more restrictions on our lives will be lifted, including moving up to 20 kilometres away from people's homes to see more people. Philip Nolan is chair of the NPHET Irish Epidemiological Modelling Advisory Group. We can speak to him now. Professor Nolan, good morning.
Morning, Gavin.
A number of weeks ago, when the reproductive rate, the number of people getting the infection from those who already had it, had been reduced, you said the prevalence of the disease was still too high. What do you think now?
Yes, indeed. What really matters here is what we call the force of infection, and that is the rate at which new cases are emerging in the population. And that's a product of the number of people out there with infection and this reproduction number that we're all familiar with now, how quickly those individuals are spreading it to others. So to ensure that the level of disease in the population remains very low, both of those parameters have to be low. You have to have a very low number of infections in the community, and you have to keep the reproduction rate at or below one. And if you keep it below one, the number of infections will ultimately decline to almost zero. So at this point in time, I did use those words, astonishingly stable. You can imagine the period immediately after the 18th of May was a period of some anxiety for the National Public Health Emergency Team, wanting and hoping that the people of Ireland would continue to be cautious and careful in how they went about their business and not spreading this disease. And over the last week to 10 days, all of the indicators suggest that there hasn't been a significant increase in the spread of the disease since the 18th of May. And that is a testament to the fact that the people of Ireland have learned how to begin to go about their business and not spread this virus.
Where is the disease now?
So the diseases are the disease. If you look at any given set of cases in a day, about half the cases are emerging as contacts of known cases, or isolated cases in the community, or cases in households, or cases in extended families. About a quarter are in healthcare workers. The incidence in healthcare workers is a tenth of what it was about a month ago, but they're still a high-risk group, and we need to do everything we can and have been doing everything we can to protect healthcare workers. And about a quarter are in the sort of outbreak settings, such as meat processing plants, and still some outbreaks in long-term residential care. So it's the cases, the low numbers of cases are emerging in a mix of settings. And it is going to be very important to watch infection prevention and control in workplace settings as more and more workplaces come back.
Much of the figures that you have been dealing with largely capture what was happening at the end of the lockdown. How will that prevalence change as we spend more time with more people?
Well, there's always going to be a risk. I mean, the spread of the disease in the population depends upon the number of contacts and how you reduce the risk of any given contact leading to infection. So for a long time into the future, we are going to have to limit our social and physical contacts to what's necessary for our well-being and for restarting the economy. So we'll always be thinking about how do we limit the number of contacts, and we'll always be thinking about how do we reduce the risk of infection. By hygiene measures, by maintaining some level of distance, when we have to come into contact with other people, by using face coverings where appropriate, and really importantly, by self-isolating as soon as we have any symptoms suggestive of this disease. All of these things come back to issues of individual responsibility to us all behaving as if there's a risk we have the virus and being really conscious of not spreading it to anybody else. If we maintain those measures and if we use our testing and contact tracing, and by use I mean that if I develop symptoms, I immediately call my GP get tested and have my contact traced. It is possible to, over time, in a cautious manner, rebuild many of our activities and not spark off further waves of infection. But I have to emphasize, any step forward we take does carry the risk and therefore requires constant monitoring of that risk of an unanticipated resurgence of the virus.
What about international experience? Other countries who are further ahead of us in terms of their easing of restriction. For example, on countries who've eased social distancing, Denmark reduced their social distancing guidelines from 2 metres to 1 metre on May the 11th. And at that time, their daily case rate has fallen from 110 new cases on May the 11th to 27 new cases on May the 25th, 32 cases yesterday. And they have their schools open. How are you using international experience to predict what will happen here?
So looking at it very carefully, as the Chief Medical Officer would have said in other contexts, we do constantly monitor what's going on in other countries. One of the things that surprises even the statisticians who understand this work very well is how long it takes for any given intervention, particularly the lifting of a restriction, to have an effect. It takes time for the disease to reemerge in the population. So first of all, we need to give it time. The second thing is we need to be very careful. So, even though we think of Western Europe as being relatively homogeneous, people behave, different countries have different cultures and different social structures. For instance, classrooms and school structures vary quite widely across Europe. So first of all, we need time. And secondly, we need to be careful of our interpretation of the results from other countries, because what happens in one context may emerge somewhat differently in another context. So very useful information, very useful evidence, very useful precedent. I just would urge two things: caution in terms of how quickly we jump to a conclusion, and then caution about how we consider the context in which, for instance, a Danish school or a Swedish school or a German school operates compared with how an Irish school operates. There are significant differences between those. But nonetheless, very valuable lessons to be learned, and therefore one of the kind of important aspects of this epidemic has been the level of collaboration across European nations, particularly through the European Centres for Disease Control, and how useful that information is collated and relayed back across the EU.
Philip Nolan, thank you very much for speaking to us, and hope to speak to you again soon. That's Philip Nolan, Chair of the National Public Health Emergency Team's Irish Epidemiological Modelling Advisory Group.
There have been more bleak warnings this week about the economic havoc unleashed by COVID-19. Both the Fiscal Advisory Council and the Economic and Social Research Institute warned the country is facing into a significant recession. The pandemic has left well over a million people requiring state income support. Joining us now this morning is the Minister for Finance, Pascal Donoghue. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
You'll have to make some big decisions soon. What will you be doing with the pandemic unemployment payment?
We'll be making a decision in relation to that across the coming weeks. The Taoiseach and I have already indicated our plan to continue the pandemic unemployment payment programme beyond the current expiry date. And we'll be making the final decision in relation to that, the duration and the nature of the payment, in the coming week or so.
I suppose the fundamental question is this: for people who had been working full time before all of this happened, will the €350 payment remain as it is?
Well, we'll be in a position to absolutely confirm that in the coming days. What I would say to those listeners who have that concern is the very reason we increased that payment from approximately €200 to €350 was in recognition of the huge difficulty that so many were facing because of the loss of income and because of the loss of job. And that instinct and that view that guided the increase in the payment, of course, will be the same instinct that will guide our view in relation to those who are in full-time work and full-time income before they lost their job.
So you hope then to keep it at 350?
Well, Rachel, we'll confirm that now when we have a cabinet meeting. What we'll have at the end of this week is we will have our second week of information, which will allow us to understand the number of citizens who are leaving the pandemic unemployment payment to go back into work. We're in the very early phase of reopening our economy, and we're looking just to take care with a decision that does two things. Firstly, recognise the need of those who are now depending on that payment for income. And secondly, just recognising that this is costing many hundreds of millions of euro per week. And any decision we make, we need to make sure is affordable and sustainable. And we're drawing that work to conclusion in the coming days.
At the moment, women returning from maternity leave are excluded from the wage subsidy scheme. Now, a lot of people have expressed concern about this. When is this loophole going to be closed?
I'll be taking a proposal to Cabinet today in relation to this, Rachel. We brought in the temporary wage subsidy scheme as a huge and fast intervention to keep many hundreds of thousands of citizens either in a job or to allow them to retain a relationship with their employer. It's been very successful in doing both. And after the introduction of this scheme, the issue regarding those on maternity leave and their inability to access the scheme was raised with me. And myself, the Department of Finance and the Revenue Commissioner have been working hard on this issue over the last number of weeks. I have a proposal. I will bring it to Cabinet today. And what I'm looking to do is try to ensure that somebody who's now leaving maternity leave to go on to the wage subsidy scheme, that we can treat them in the same way as somebody else who may already have been on the wage subsidy scheme. I accept the concerns that were raised. It's our absolute intention to treat everybody fairly. And I hope later on today we'll be able to bring clarity to that important issue.
Looking at the broader picture, the European Commission has proposed a 750 billion euro package of grants and loans to help countries recover from this crisis. When's that likely to be finalised, and what will Ireland be looking for?
So in terms of that broader picture, if I could briefly say, in acknowledging the huge difficulty that you picked up on correctly in the two reports that were published earlier on in the week, the reports were also clear that our economy can recover and we can make the right decisions to get our economy and our people to a better place economically. And we can do that because we didn't have the kind of economic difficulties leading into this crisis we've had in the past. In terms of the European Recovery Fund, when will it be finalised? My anticipation is it will be finalised towards the end of this year. And funding from it will become available either from the end of this year or early next year. In terms of what Ireland will want from us, there's two things we will want. You know, very directly, of course, we will be reviewing that fund to see if there's an opportunity for us to fund programmes that we currently have in Ireland or to fund new things better in the future. Indirectly, however, this fund and the work of the European Central Bank is the vital sign of confidence regarding the future of the euro. That confidence was lacking a decade ago. And as a country who's a member of the euro and a big trading small country in the eurozone, that kind of confidence is a vital enabler of the economic recovery we want to return Ireland to.
Again, looking at the overall sums here, both Fianna Fáil and the Greens made pre-election pledges not to increase the pension age to 67. Given everything that's happened since then, is that still realistic?
Well, Rachel, I'm engaging with my colleagues in the Green Party and Fianna Fáil on this and a whole range of matters.
Right, and so you are discussing that.
I said in relation to a whole range of matters, and of course, how we're going to manage pension issues, how we're going to manage the future of our income supports will all be part of the discussion that we will have. These are discussions that we're hoping to use to form a new government. And one of the agreements that we've made is we won't make public our conclusions until that work has concluded. The context for all of these decisions has completely changed because of COVID, because of having hundreds of thousands of people now unemployed. But we will only be able to answer questions like that if we can agree a programme for government. And we're working really hard to try to do that at the moment.
There have been concerted calls this week for the reduction of the 2 metre distancing rule. Your own cabinet colleague, Michael Ring, thinks it should be reduced. What's your view?
I'm going to be very much guided by the public health guidance in this area, as indeed all my cabinet colleagues are. I just had to listen to Professor Philip Nolan, been interviewed before I came on, to be reminded of the kind of expertise and insight that Philip and his colleagues have on this and many other matters. We will look at the evidence in this, and I will be guided, excuse me, Rachel, by that evidence and by the success that we have in reopening our economy while hopefully containing this disease.
Right. Does that mean then that for as long as Tony Houlihan says 2 metres, you're sticking with 2 metres?
Well, I'll take his advice and input in the matter very carefully, and then I'll seek to balance that against all of the other things that I'm directly responsible for as Minister for Finance.
What does that mean?
Philip, in the interview that he gave a few moments ago, for example, made the point that getting people back to work is not only vital for our economy. He talked about the, you know, many of the different costs and issues that we have at the moment in our economy. I'm directly responsible for all of that. But what I want to do is that if we make further decisions to reopen our economy, that we do that in a way that does not undermine the success that we have had in containing this disease. And in order to look at that success, I will be relying on a weekly basis on the kind of information and advice that we get from Tony and his team. And if the evidence supports any kind of change in the public health guidance, and I believe we can accept that guidance and reopen our economy in a careful way so that we can get more people back to work, of course, we look at those conclusions.
Pascal Donoghue, Minister for Finance, thank you for joining us this morning. It's 8:34.
Jill Steadman has the business news.
Thanks, Gavin. Renault has announced nearly 15,000 job losses worldwide, including 4,600 in France. It's part of a €2 billion cost-cutting plan over 3 years. The group, which is 15% owned by the government, had earlier this year flagged financial problems before the COVID-19 outbreak. Meanwhile, Volkswagen is to pump €2 billion into 2 separate Chinese electric vehicle players. The joint venture will launch 5 more electric models over the next 5 years. The German carmaker aims to sell 1.5 million new energy vehicles in China by 2025. Foreign direct investment to Ireland is expected to drop by 20% this year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. That's according to a new report from EY Ireland. It expects that Ireland will fare better than many other countries post-COVID-19. Ireland currently ranks number 8 in Europe in terms of attractiveness for foreign investors. Finally, for now, a look at the currencies. €1 buys 89.9 pence sterling and $1 11 cents.
And with the sport, here's Darren Frehel.
Good morning, Rachel. All going well. This time next year, we'll be getting ready to cheer on our Olympic and our Paralympic athletes in Tokyo. But are they already on the back foot when it comes to competition? Athletes slowly but surely returning to training, but with the 5 kilometre travel restrictions, many cannot access specialised facilities which are essential for what they're doing. Meanwhile, many of the competitors internationally are getting back to normal. Peter Sherrard, CEO of the Olympic Council of Ireland, joins me on the line. Peter, what is the issue here and what would you like done about it?
Good morning, Darren. Yes, really, it's just a bit of nuance and flexibility to be shown towards approximately 200 Olympic and Paralympic athletes throughout the country. We're not asking for a massive amount, but to give you a fairly simple example, you'd have rowers, for example, our Olympic rowers at the can't get to their national training centre because it's more than 5 kilometres from their houses. And yet, rowing clubs all across the country are open in line with phase 1 government protocols. So there's no problem with rowing itself. It's just the waiver to get to the centres. So that's the kind of thing that with a little responsiveness, we could arrange for our athletes who really do deserve it. Sport Ireland have been working very hard with the departments and the officials to request this. Unfortunately, we haven't had green lights from health at this stage. And it is becoming an issue because across Europe, national training centres, Olympic training centres are reopening for that very small group of athletes in line with very, very detailed health protocols. And our athletes are now being left behind. They're seeing their counterparts across Europe return to training, return to facilities that they use to train, albeit in a different manner because of the new protocols. And it's growing, leading to a great sense of frustration from them. And it makes it very difficult because they can see that they're losing touch with their competitors.
Peter, it's all very well easing restrictions, but there's still a very delicate situation in this country. I'm sure you can appreciate that. If allowed to travel, won't these athletes then be putting themselves and others at risk?
Yeah, look, we're not being dismissive of that. And I think it's very, very important that health and the safety of the athletes is put to the fore. First of all, the protocols for a return have been medically reviewed, and there's no vested interest here. The athletes aren't doing this for money or profit. They're doing it because they want to stay in touch with their competitors and to be able to not to fall behind. It's very, very simple, really, for them to get back into. To give another example, a cyclist who is able to cycle in their area and they're preparing for the Olympics and they can go no more than 5 kilometres outside their area. There's no great health risk, for example, to give a waiver to that cyclist to be able to travel a further distance. You're not talking about a great number of people. Again, you're talking about probably 200 Olympic and Paralympic athletes throughout the country. And we hope to be cheering them and supporting them next year. They do a great job for us to represent us internationally. And what we're asking for isn't particularly significant. It just needs a little bit of nuance and a little bit of flexibility. And I think by working together
and finally,
with the finally, and providing those assurances, we can do that.
Finally, and very, very briefly, Peter, if they're not lifted, what's going to happen here?
If they're not lifted, I think, first of all, the athletes will suffer. And there are a lot of athletes who would be, you know, in contention to be able to qualify for Olympics. But it would be on a knife edge. There's a lot of competition out there. For example, in swimming, you might have your relay team, which would be sitting 13th or 14th in the world. And they're competing against nations which are back in the water. So that's an example where, genuinely, our relay teams for swimming could lose out. That's just one of many examples. The other thing that could happen, and this would be very, very unfortunate, is that athletes will take the decision themselves to move out of the country because they have to actually keep their Olympic hopes, Olympic and Paralympic hopes alive. And the only way they can do that is by going to countries where the restrictions are being adopted, albeit in line with health protocols, in a more common sense fashion.
Peter Sherrard, thanks for joining us here on Morning Ireland. Let's finish with a GAA memory, and one I hope will put a smile on your face this morning. Not much to say by way of introduction. What happens when you put an outspoken critic up against a team with a point to prove? Here's your answer.
Rolly, I do have to ask you something. You upset a lot of Kerry people recently by comments that you made about the Kerry team, particularly about Gooch Cooper. You described him as a choker.
When you're looking at someone like Colm Cooper, who's obviously one of the modern greats, I mean, really, I was thinking about the Kerry team in general. A team stands and stares them in the face for 70 minutes. On those occasions, Armagh, Tyrone 3 times, Dublin last year, Kerry have looked down first. As we've seen, on each occasion that has happened...
How many All-Irelands have Kerry won?
I appreciate that.
This present team.
Absolutely right. But the point that I'm making is
when
this...
you're explaining, they're in trouble.
They go out, they blitz Mayo early on and they collapse. Blitz Mayo and collapse.
He's digging.
Hold on.
Could we get a bigger shovel for Joe, please?
Digging. Hold on a second. Hold on a second. Nobody's digging. It's a fact of life.
He's a good midfield option, a powerful runner. And Kieran Donoghue has the ball from Durkin's kick and he's buried it into the back of the net. What on earth did Donegal do straight from the kick out? They gifted possession to Kieran Donoghue and Kerry have their second goal. Kerry have done what Kerry do in September in Croke Park and they are All-Ireland champions for the 37th time.
Joe Brawley told us the production line was finished in Kerry. Well, Joe Brawley, what do you think of that?
Starman Kieran Donoghue at the end of the 2014 All-Ireland final between Kerry and Donegal, ending that report by Darren Farrell. For younger listeners, That was the last time that Dublin didn't win the All-Ireland Football Final. A blessing for frontline workers. Religious congregations of different denominations have recorded a protective hymn to thank those fighting against COVID-19. The project is called the Irish Blessing. It's part of an international Christian movement. Organisers hope it can go viral. Kian McCormack sent us this report.
Be thou my vision.
A hymn for frontline workers.
My heart.
Be thou my vision. A song here by Sherry Hazlett Gallen.
Save that thou art.
She's upstairs in the Holy Trinity Church in Rathmines. The church is at the core of the Irish Blessing Initiative.
Or sleeping, thy presence, my life.
The Irish Blessing is part of an international movement where churches come together to bless frontline workers, those on the front line dealing with the coronavirus.
An Irish take on a world phenomenon.
It began in the United States about 2 months ago, and then a number of countries have picked this up and have had this collaborative effort to bless those dealing with the pandemic.
Philip McKinley, a Dublin-based Church of Ireland ordinand, is one of the organisers.
So we've taken what is a prayer of protection, the very famous hymn, Be Thou My Vision. And we have got 250 churches together, north, south, east and west, representing every county in the island. And we have sung together collectively this ancient, over 1,000-year-old hymn and prayer of protection for Ireland at this time.
250 versions of Be Thou My Vision were recorded and sent to organisers.
And capturing this snapshot of actually Irish Christianity in 2020, and that is ranges from Orthodox churches to Catholic churches to independent evangelical, charismatic, Pentecostal churches, a lot of new migrant-led churches. We've captured an enormous range and Christian organizations working within some of those spheres as well.
Be thou my wisdom, be thou my true word.
The monks of Glen Stoll sent this version. While the Solid Rock Pentecostal Church in Dublin 8 submitted this one.
High King of Heaven, my victory won, may I reach heaven.
Selected versions of the hymn will be edited together into a 6-minute piece due to be launched this Sunday. Again, Philip McKinley.
This is going to be launched on 31st of May, which is Pentecost Sunday, the birthday of the church. It will be available on the Irish Blessing YouTube channel and also shareable on the Irish Blessing Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and www.theirishblessing.com.
Be thou my battle shield, sword for the fight.
The Holy Trinity Church in Rathmines is one of the 250 congregations involved. Singer Sherry Hazlett Gallen, who we heard earlier and we hear now singing this version of Be Thou My Vision, is the worship coordinator at the church.
Raise thou me heavenward, O power of my power.
I love the idea of an all-inclusive worship where there are no walls, no borders, and all are welcome to engage with the divine. Ultimately, God is for everybody, and that's what my music says, and that's what this project says too.
Reverend Rob Jones, the Church of Ireland rector at the Holy Trinity, holds a similar view.
Being a part of something with all those people across the island that brings unity is really important, but also having the opportunity to say thank you to frontline workers, having the opportunity to pray a blessing of thankfulness over all those diverse people who've done so much in this pandemic is very important to me as a church leader, to say thank you, but also to bless them and all they've done.
Reverend Rob Jones ending that report by Kian McCormack. The Irish Blessing video will go live on YouTube and on social media on Sunday morning. More details from irishblessing.com. 8:51.
If this was a normal June bank holiday, 120,000 people would be expected to visit the Phoenix Park in Dublin for the Bloom Festival. But like the rest of us, this year Bloom has had to go digital. Tara McCarthy is the CEO of Bord Bia, which organises the Bloom Festival. Tara, no Bloom in real life this year, so what will there be?
Good morning. Well, I know for an event that normally takes us 12 months to plan, we're now after pivoting and going online to Bloom at Home. So on Sunday, we're going to be hosting this event online, encouraging the Irish public to come together and I guess bloom from their own homes this year, supporting our artisans, supporting our entrepreneurs, supporting the garden designers as well. So basically from 11 o'clock, we're going to be streaming from our Facebook page. We've been fantastically supported by our patron and president, Michael D. Higgins, who'll be addressing from Oras an Uachtaráin at 11 o'clock. And then we're going to have the day planned. So at 11:30, we'll have a panel, I guess, discussing how to design a show garden, because that's been such a feature of everything that we've had at Bloom. It's been really the standout piece. So designers like Andrew Dunn, Jane McCorkrell, Oliver Shurman, all previous gold winners, overall winners, will be chatting with our own Gary Graham on that. We'll also be having the likes of Nevin McGuire, who has never missed a bloom, no more than ourselves. He'll be doing a quality kitchen cook-along. We'll have garden safaris with the holistic gardener Fiona Nulon, and we'll also then have gardening for well-being as well. But what this is all about is to try and bring that amazing feeling that people normally get when they walk into the Phoenix Park. But they'll have that hopefully either in their own garden, in their own balcony, as they look at their own windowsills as well, because we can create opportunities to support Irish food, to support Irish garden centres, to promote Irish plants as well. So there's going to be a really great fun day. We have all of our information on boardbeabloom.com. You can buy products as if you were in the virtual food village. You can support, whether that's the premium butcher with the meat lovers pack as you're barbecuing, whether it's the velvet cloud looking at your sheep milk or your sheep milk yogurt or goat's bridge
all
trout,
right, so,
have
so it's all there.
It is
the big irony here is that if ever there was a year when we had the weather for Bloom, this was it.
The number of infant of prags that we normally have around the place for this weekend is countless, but it is a fantastic weekend. But this is all about celebrating your garden, celebrating the fantastic food and drink. So we think that by coming together, we can do that. And we've tied in with, obviously, with RTE as well to create another event within that, which is Bloom with RTE, and a competition to really celebrate that and bring the fun out of that as well. So we're looking for creative images, whether that's on and coming through on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and there's five categories: the nature friendly space, community spirit, the best crack garden, the best balcony or windowsill, and a judge's favourite garden.
Looking forward to the best crack garden. Tara McCarthy, thank you very much. Those details, rte.ie/lifestyle, and as she said, there are prizes and everything apparently.
Fáilte rót muid seo cliona. Now, for many of our audience, you'll need no introduction, but for everyone
Hello,
else...
Hello, Cathal Sheff.
You're one of the teachers on RTÉ's School Hub, a very familiar presence in the lives of primary school children and a welcome relief for weary homeschoolers. Today, it's Sports Day Finals.
It is, yeah, absolutely. So all this week we've been kind of having our sports week, because this is obviously the week kind of in and around the week where schools would be holding their own sports days. So kind of we wanted to do something similar for people to take part in. So we've had Olympians that might have been going to Tokyo this year come in to the homeschool hub and kind of tell us about themselves and then take part in different little activities. So some of the activities are a ring toss. We have an obstacle course, egg and spoon race, sack race, and then water gun and kind of empty cans and kind of aiming, kind of shooting game. And then basically then the pinnacle now is today. So they get to choose their favourite event and do their time on it. And then the teachers as well took part in it. And we're encouraging everybody to doesn't matter you don't have to be able to do all these activities at least. And then if people people sent in their photographs or videos into us at rte.ie/learn or to the Irish Olympic Federation, then they will be sent their very own certificate from the Olympic Federation of Participation.
Tina, there's a slight delay on the line. We know that many homes have been very grateful for your work over the last 10 weeks, and we hope you're going to be doing it for the next few more. Do you expect to be back in the classroom in September?
Well, I suppose that's the kind of provisional date. It would be hard to foresee that in terms of managing social distancing with children. I think that would be a huge challenge. But I know that there's different measures being taken in different countries to enable children to return to school. So I suppose we can hopefully kind of maybe follow a kind of global example before returning to school ourselves.
And are you on for the next few weeks?
We are, yeah, we're running until the 19th of June, and that's it then. But we've enjoyed it tremendously, and we're having great fun and getting great responses, and children seem to be enjoying it and are sending us in the most beautiful work imaginable. So we're very, very happy.
Hugely popular in this house. Lina Ní Chiosán, thank you very much for speaking to a primary school teacher and one of the presenters of RTE's Homeschool Hub. 2 minutes to 9.